Welcome to the SLS cast episode eventually. That's right, we keep dropping in and out of the world, and it makes it very difficult for you to figure out when the hell we're ever going to do a show.
Life.
You know what? We shoot for one a week, and we're really sorry at this point, but we're just going to have to roll with life. I had to move. Tim's had school. I've had school on top of having to move. And we're all together now. So thanks for being patient and waiting and loving us and listening and checking. And for those of you who subscribe to iTunes, I guess I'm glad that iTunes tells you when there's a new episode. So, what you been doing there, Tim?
Studying. I'm a history minor, so I've been doing a ton of reading and a ton of paper writing, most of it about genocide and the Cuban slave trade. So it's very, very depressing. It's been a very sad couple weeks.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. That's going to go right into the script idea that we've decided to approach developing in January with regards to our Native American peoples who...
Oh, yes.
who get the tour of New York City to impress upon them the power of the white man, and yet how friendly we are, only to get shot on sight at your next meeting with the white man. That's kind of sad.
Yeah, so if you are a fan of the show, we totally spoiled our first movie for you.
That's right, that's right. Except that this particular story we're talking about is actually a historical incident that really happened. So if once we get a little further along and we tell you who we're talking about, it's not like you couldn't Wikipedia or Google or what have you and figure
good
it out
point.
For yourself.
Good point. How was your 11-11-11? Or what they call Veterans Day, or more famously, Nigel Tufnel Day.
Why Nigel Tufnel Day?
These go to 11. They named it Nigel Tufnel Day.
Gotcha.
Yeah, Spinal Tap.
Why not just make 10 louder? But these go to 11.
11.
So yeah, don't touch that. Don't touch that ever. But not don't touch it then. Oh, okay. So yeah, no, that's good. My 11-11-11 was relatively uneventful. Ha ha ha! There you go, make a little punny. And it was pretty cool. My 11-11-11 in the morning of 11-11-11, as well as my 11-11-11 in the evening of 11-11-11. All pretty normal. Can't say anything special happened.
Cool. Awesome.
And how about you?
You know, I conquered the world. That's what I did on my 11-11.
That is just the way to 11. Go. Well, enough hodgepodging. Let's see.
that is definitely hodgepodging.
Yes, that's right. Sure. Let's see. I guess, seriously, though, I mean, you've had school.
Yeah.
I've had school and moving, and it looks like we have made it through all of it, and I guess... Shall we just move into news then? Since everybody's honky dory and nothing really exciting to tell.
Yeah, no, I think we're both honky. So let's do it.
Let's dory it up, honky. News, start, ready, go.
Okay. Start, do now. News, fire, bad, caveman, lawyer. Okay,
I'm a Dalek. News now, do the news now.
Terminate. Well, and speaking of Daleks, Doctor Who, you are a very big Doctor Who fan.
Yes, I am.
Well, they are planning a Doctor Who movie to come out in the next few years. David Yates, the director of the last handful of Harry Potter films, is apparently a big Doctor Who fan as well. And he wants to create a film that is completely separate from the current Doctor Who TV series, as well as the older TV series, which the current one is the continuation of. I guessing his reasons are that he doesn't want to get the two confused, which I think is a good idea. However, if it's released the same time that the series is going on, I think that will confuse a lot more people and may or may not turn people away from the franchise if the movie is bad. So, I guess that's my view of it and that of the news. of that particular thing, I guess.
Okay. I must chime in as an avid Doctor Who fan. This is about the most ill-conceived Doctor Who concept I can possibly think of. The entirety of the universe with which Doctor Who is contained is because it is all-encompassing. And the writers over the years, and the brilliance of the executive producers over the years, the timing, for the most part, there was the standalone pilot back in 96 that didn't get picked up, but still counts as part of the canon.
I thought was that not the movie?
It was a movie, but it was a standalone pilot. So it was done as a movie that was left open to become be the pilot, so that if people liked it, they were going to
continue as an actual
series.
Gotcha.
The only problem, and that's what makes it, is because it's all under the umbrella. And so the rabid base that they have, both in the UK and the growing fan base here in the United States, is because of the continuing storyline. And to try and just pick and choose something and say, oh, it's not canon, and we're just doing our own reboot, it's ridiculous. It's because you're not... Because people who aren't familiar with Doctor Who are only going to know it based off what little or no first-hand knowledge they have from the TV series that they may or may not have ever seen or heard of. And so they're going to dismiss it versus the people who are actually fans of the series, who are going to be brought into something that is completely unrelated to anything that they know, and it's just going to either confuse them or ruin the experience for them. I'm not seeing this as a good idea.
Yeah, that's pretty much the making sense version of what I said 5 minutes ago.
Okay,
sorry. I agree.
I didn't hear anything in there in your story about it being a bad idea.
It
might confuse people.
It will confuse people.
Okay, my bad. I wasn't trying to like...
Oh, no, but you explained it so much better. I approve. You're good.
Oh. Nice. Great. Way to get back into the rhythm, Tim. Outstanding.
Yes.
All right, next news item. Sorry.
All right. So, what was the big movie that opened up this past weekend? I believe it was about vampires and... werewolves?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure the big movie that opened up this last weekend was The Descendants. Or are we talking about a big movie that was not good?
Probably a big movie that would never be considered good.
Oh, well, in that case, that one might have involved vampires.
Yes. Twilight, Breaking Dawn.
Breaking Bad. No, you know what? Breaking Bad. That's awesome. We should totally call it that. Twilight, Breaking Bad.
Starring Bryan Cranston as Ed.
He accidentally develops an interesting strain of crystal meth that turns good actors into bad actors who play vampires and werewolves. Go.
Hey, you know, that would be the better movie.
I think so. I'd watch it.
Yeah, especially if it was filmed just like Breaking Bad. It might be a little bit badass. So I would follow that franchise.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but Breaking Dawn opened this past weekend, and it is apparently the fifth best weekend opener of all time, with $139.5 million.
Okay, is this supposed to be one of those really limited categories, like kind of like they did with Paranormal Activity 3, where it was, you know, the best horror opening of a particular franchise triplet sequel on an October weekend in October in a year that ended with a one?
Well, no. I mean, this is actually the best, you know, of weekend. Yeah, just period. Weekend.
Just flat out.
Ever.
Like, okay, yeah, so just, what are like the top, what are the other four?
I have no idea. Well, but what you have to keep in mind is the influx in money and how much a ticket is worth. That's what a lot of these people don't take into consideration. So to where one will say, oh, it beat out A New Hope by a landslide with how much it made.
Yeah,
again, it's like, well, you know, $100 million back in 1977 is how much now?
Yeah, maybe, it'd be like a billion and a half today. Yeah, because when you take into account in the price of inflation, I believe it's Gone with the Wind is still the number one movie of all time.
Yes, yeah. And E.T. is number three or four or something.
Yeah, two. And what makes E.T., personally, I think E.T. should be... E.T. should be a number two, if not number one. Well, I guess well-deserved number two is my personal opinion, because, we take into account inflation. So, okay, fine. We'll give Gone with the Wind its due. Because, tickets started at, a dime back then. But when you think about E.T. was a family movie, so that got to be as big as it was on kids' prices, yeah. Which back in the 80s were like $2. That's ridiculous that E.T. made that much money. So go Spielberg. He's the man.
Yeah,
I'm going to see War Horse, damn it.
What's that?
I said, I'm going to see War Horse, damn it.
Oh, I am too. And I'm going to bring plenty of tissues. Because there's one thing can make me just cry is the emotional tearing between a boy and his horse. That is movie drama right there in purest form. Besides Breaking Dawn news and Doctor Who news, I have Oscar news. To whereas the last time you folks out there in internet land, whenever you have heard the lovely voices of Matt and I, there was news that Eddie Murphy was going to host the Academy Awards with Brett Ratner of Rush Hour fame, directing fame, was supposed to direct. Oh, no, excuse me. He was supposed to produce.
Produce it, yeah.
Yeah, he's supposed to produce it. However, he kind of made a little comment about, gay folk, and he didn't say gay folk. He said the F word, the bad gay folk.
He said the bundle of sticks word.
Or yes,
the
or
British slang for cigarette.
Yes, that's exactly what he said. And it threw me a whole lot of hoopla, and he should have just stayed and done it, but considering just a whole lot of hoopla, and he resigned. And as well as Eddie Murphy resigned from doing or backed down from hosting, which I thought would have been pretty good for him at least. Now, instead of Eddie Murphy and Brett Ratner, you have Brian Grazer, who has pretty much produced almost all of Ron Howard's films. He's going to be producing, as well as Billy Crystal will return to host. So you lose Eddie Murphy and you gain Billy Crystal. I am not going to complain about that, actually.
Nor I. And I must say, back in his three-stint run, because he did them 3 years in a row,
yeah.
Back in the early 90s, I was one of the people they had. There was a campaign. This was back when the internet was still relatively new, and AOL was king back then. This was, with dial-up and the 386. If that tells you how long ago it was. There was actually an internet campaign to make Billy Crystal the lifetime host of the Oscars.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was on that bandwagon. And then, of course, he announces, "I'm stepping down. I don't want to do it anymore. It's too much." he's like, "I can't top myself." He's like, "I can't keep topping myself. There's no way I can do it." And he said it was just too much work to try and figure out ways to top himself, and he stepped down.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad he's back.
So yeah, I'm very excited. I can't wait to see what he does.
Yeah, and also the TV show The Munsters. You know The Munsters. I would hope you would. Yeah, well, they are bringing the show back. In the 80s, do you remember what was it called? I think the show was The Munsters in the 80s, or I don't flippin' know. But it was an actual TV show that lasted a handful of seasons. And it was The Munsters as if they lived in the 80s. It was ridiculous.
I don't know. I know Ben Stiller, when the Ben Stiller show, when he had his Ben Stiller show on Fox back in the early 90s, he had a segment where he played Eddie Munster.
Oh, he did? Oh,
yeah.
That's right. Yes.
And he was in the drawer. He was in, so they pull out the drawer and all that stuff. So I remember that. I don't remember a show referencing the Munsters in the 80s, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, I will.
Well, just not to say I don't believe you. I personally don't remember that. That's the only thing I remember.
Well, it's ridiculous. I highly suggest you look it up sometime. It is horrendous because it's actually the Munsters in the 80s. It's horrible. However, NBC is willing to bring back the Munsters. However, not in a half-hour, lighthearted family comedy setting, but instead in a one-hour dramatic setting with, peppered with comedy and, I guess, visuals to look at, seeing how the helmer of the show Pushing Daisies, which I don't know if you watch Pushing Daisies or not.
I loved Pushing Daisies. I was so upset when they canceled it.
Yeah, it was a good show.
And when we were talking pre-show, and you had mentioned it at first, and I was like, I'm not seeing it as a drama. I can't see, or as a dramedy or whatever. I just can't see it. I think it's a terrible idea. And then you had said, yeah, it's going to be done by the dude who did Pushing Daisies. And I was like, I don't know. That might work. But then I'm just worried that it would go the way of Pushing Daisies, which would be sad.
Yeah,
Pushing Daisies is now proverbially Pushing Daisies. So that's weird. Okay.
Yeah, it turns out they live down the street from the pie shop and they incorporate the same characters.
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay, and here's the last few bit of news. The new Bond film, as in James Bond film, they're currently filming with Sam Mendes directing. It's called Skyfall. Javier Bardem will be the villain. Also, just recently, the whole Nappy Wood case.
Really? Okay, yeah. Nappy Wood case, yeah.
Yes, the whole Nappy Wood case is being opened up. And again, Robert Wagner is still being accused of throwing her overboard. And I guess Christopher Walken might be... I guess that's also another little myth that he might have had a little hand in it, seeing how it was Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken who was one who retrieved her from the water. Now, last but not least...
No, they never found her body.
I thought they did. I'm pretty sure they found their body. Because there was a thing where they found her and she was in a nightgown and she had her some kind of shoes on. I could have sworn I read something about
that. You might be right. I don't recall her being...
Because they said it was like a mile away from the yacht they were on. Because somebody was talking about it.
Yeah, that's right here. I'm checking. I mean, for whatever it's worth, it's Wikipedia. But Nappy Wood was buried. Okay, yeah, my bad.
Yeah, so it's just interesting. It's actually, I believe, the police department there. The sheriff opened it up, or I guess after petitioning people, I don't know, but it's more of a local investigation than a statewide investigation, so I found that to be pretty interesting. I think it'll make for a great Lifetime movie coming up in the next couple years, seeing what happens.
Sure.
Yeah, and last but not least, I just have a couple movie trailer recommendations. One is Mirror Mirror, which is Tarsim, his take on Snow White. He just came out with Immortals. He recently did, about a decade ago, he made the movie The Cell. So check out the film. I will be interested in hearing people's comments because the trailer visually looks stunning, but yeah, you just gotta check it out. The second one is called Casa de Mi Padre. It's a Mexican film, and actually, it's a Mexican comedy starring Will Ferrell. So that actually looks pretty interesting and a nice little new, fun, hopefully fresh direction of comedy that Will Ferrell will be partaking in that I will actually stand to watch. But yeah, so those are my news.
Okay, well, I've got some... nothing. Okay, sure. Well, whatever. No grammar please today. I'm not going to worry about that. I have three absolutely uplifting news pieces, if you consider things about death and bankruptcy being uplifting.
Nice.
Yes, it's more than likely you've already heard this stuff, but just in case you live under a rock somewhere, you're like those dudes in the Geico commercial. Heavy D, the rapper Heavy D, born Dwight Arrington Myers, passed away at 44. He essentially, if I understand it correctly, he suffocated. More than likely, problems due to his weight. He had a fabulous send-off, and unfortunately he did leave a daughter behind, but Obama sent a note to his funeral, so I guess that was pretty classy. So we'll have a link to that Associated Press story. And I was very sad to hear this myself, but Bill Keane, He was the creator of Family Circus. He passed away at 89. And I, for one, thoroughly enjoyed Family Circus, both growing up and whenever I picked up a paper. It was still nice to see even today that Family Circus was still going and modern, given a modern touch in terms of things that they might have talked about, but still that classic feel that you can truly, that Family Circus truly gave, because you could look at it when you were a kid and just maybe think it was funny, just something that was funny, but then as you look back on it as you get older, you can truly appreciate it for the crap you pulled that you see them that you see them talking about. Or in my case, as I've come to have kids and I watch what they've done and see it perpetuated in the print there, it's great. So I was very sad to see that, so I'll have a link there. And then last but not least, Chris Tucker is of Rush Hour fame, primarily. He's apparently having some money issues, and looks like he is going to be foreclosed upon on his Florida home. But he bought it, like, back in 2007?
Mm-hmm.
But he bought it for, like, about $6 million, and unfortunately, the recession hit everybody, including rich people, and his house is currently worth $1.6. So he is massively upside down in that house.
Oh, yeah. No kidding.
And he's not making a lot of money right now because apparently they're not going to do a Rush Hour 27. So.
Good. Did you see the horrible Rush Hour 3?
I did not. I stopped at Rush Hour 2. And I was willing to give Rush Hour 3 a shot simply because I enjoyed Rush Hour. And I thought Rush Hour 2 was, it wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible either. So I was willing to give Rush Hour 3 a shot, but then all of a sudden I saw just how bad it was getting. I was like, oh, you know what? I think I'll just wait for DVD on that one, and never got around to it, and I'm not sorry. So that's what I have for you. Those are the three news stories that I have.
Ah, well, very informative.
There you go. Very very sad, unfortunately. We lost a legend in the R&B rapping world. We lose a legend in the comic strip media.
And then we lose Chris Tucker.
Yeah, and Chris Tucker loses his house. I'll tell you what, though. He is welcome to crash at my pad, but he has to, once a day, he just has to say, you got knocked the fuck out! I mean, that he just has to say that once a day, and he can stay here. Anytime he wants, he can crash at my house, or he could quote any particular line that he chooses from The Fifth Element. That would also be fine.
Oh, okay.
Three squared. What do you think? Three squared. Let's talk
about
three squared.
Yeah, let's talk about three squared.
All right. So three squared. We're kind of liking the offbeat categories that we're coming up with that aren't necessarily tied down to one person. And so since we've kind of morphed it away from one person, this week our category was so good we decided to not limit it to three movies, but we each found four.
Yes.
So the category was, for those who don't have long memories, and well, I don't blame you, it was your favorite movie, or movies, rather, based on a historical period. Now, it didn't have to be 100% factual, but just as long as it was a period piece, something that covered a particular time or a particular era. Interestingly enough, we both picked a movie that's been done, but we picked two different
versions.
Yeah, two different versions of the same movie. So, Tim, fire away. Tell us what your movies were.
Okay, well, actually, my version of this particular movie is from 1973, and it is The Three Musketeers. Yes, the Richard Lester version stars Oliver Reed, Raquel Welch, Faye Dunaway is in it, Christopher Lee, Charlton Heston, Richard Chamberlain, Michael York is a D'Artagnan in it. And as you know, the director, Richard Lester, he also did the Beatles, both Beatles movies, Help, Hard Day's Night. He did Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Superman 2 and 3, just a bunch of whole variety of films. And holy crap, this version of The Three Musketeers, in my opinion, is absolutely, it's wonderful. It's beautiful to look at. It's incredibly funny. It's impeccably charming. And you have the suspense and the wit and just the all-out fun swashbuckling excitement. It's, and it features some of the greatest fight scenes I have. Just great duelings. And I highly, highly recommend it. Of course, I don't really have to go into much detail about the premise, but it's a very historical type film. It takes place during, in Paris, just a great rivalry between London and Paris going on, and just, Paris was up in arms and a lot of fighting and looting and against the government and all that fun and exciting stuff. And if you haven't seen, which I'm pretty sure everybody has at least familiar with either the version that good old Matt will be talking about here in a little bit, or even the 1993 with Kiefer Sutherland and Oliver Platt and
Rebecca De Mornay,
and Chris O'Donnell and what's his name, crazy ass Charlie Sheen. Isn't Charlie Sheen in it?
Oh yeah, that's right, he is in it. Holy crap.
Yeah, so The Three Musketeers, 1973. My second film is probably one that maybe 0.02% of anybody listening to this might have actually seen it, if not even heard of it. I actually just recently watched it in a class. It's called Sugarcane Alley. It's based on one of the Caribbean islands called Martinique in the early 1930s. Martinique was one of the French-occupied Caribbean islands that took part in the slave trade and cane cutting and coffee growing and all that groovy stuff from the early 1900s. It started off in the mid-1800s. This particular film takes place after the abolition of slavery and about the slave life post-abolition era, where a lot of slaves still worked cutting cane. However, they lived more in villages. They got paid, if you want to call it a wage, but they still got paid, and they had a wee bit more respect than, I guess, what the slaves or the generation of slaves before them had. Again, the film's about the slavery post-abolition. Highly recommend it. It's in French, so you have to read subtitles, deal with it. But it's great acting, great performances, and great storytelling. It's really a gem of a film. Very much so a gem of a film. Highly recommend it. The last film of mine is called Letters from Iwo Jima. Came out in 2006, directed by Clint Eastwood. This was the second of two films that were filmed back-to-back dealing with, were actually pertaining to the same issue. The first one was Flags of Our Fathers through the eyes of the Americans during World War II, during the battle of, or actually the take of Iwo Jima. And this one is actually from the side of the Japanese, and it stars Ken Watanabe as it's great. Terrific film. Very sad. This is basically one of the only maybe a handful of World War II, actually just war movies in general, to where it's solely based on the enemy, or what we call the enemy, but however it brings such a human character element to it, to where, they're fighting for land as what we were fighting for, taking land, gaining land for our military and just keeping, the Japanese away and keeping them from taking over the Pacific, which then they would take over Australia, and just all this stuff. And it's just fascinating just seeing this from a different perspective. Again, it's gut-wrenching. It'll just tear the heart right out of you, if you own one, I suppose, which I would hope many of you do. And actually, I said this is my last one, but since we were doing four films, my last one is Amadeus. Came out in the late 80s, again about Wolfgang Amadeus. Great film. amazing. That's all I can really say about it. In fact, a little story about Amadeus. When the film came out, my dad didn't want anything to do with it because he thought the film was a musical, seeing how that song Rock Me Amadeus came out around the same time. But then again, they named me. They wanted to name me Wolfgang after the movie. So, and that did not happen because my grandmother completely shot it down. No way in hell my grandchild's going to be named Wolfgang Eladwicius Kuzniar. So, yeah. So now I'm Tim. That people call me. But, yeah. Letters from Iwo Jima, Amadeus, Three Musketeers, Sugarcane Alley, Three Squared. Take it over, Matt.
Outstanding, sir. Let's see here. I also have four movies because we said we're doing four movies. And my version of Three Musketeers predates Tim's version. And when we were doing the pre-show, he was like, yeah, you know, this is the classic Three Musketeers. And I was like, oh, you're talking about the one with Gene Kelly? And he was like, no, I'm talking... So we both have these classic versions of the Three Musketeers in our heads. And they're both good versions. I'm not going to sit here and try and say mine's better or his is better. I think they're both worth watching. I would not consider watching them back-to-back because their plots are so similar, as they are based on the Alexandre Dumas novel.
Just as a side note, I think mine is more reflective from the book itself.
Yes. Apparently. Yeah. The again, this is the golden age of Hollywood in 1948. So, key plot points are there, but it's definitely done for an American audience in 1948. Make no mistake. You have the Three Musketeers, you have D'Artagnan, you have the initial duel set up, you have De Winter and her evilness, you have the court hierarchy system set up, and you have the, you know, trying to get De Winter to justice. That's really about all that's from the book, truly, into this movie. Everything else is definitely in the style of Hollywood during that era. That being said, this is what swashbuckling was based on going forward. Okay, the only movie with good swashbuckling, personally, that predates this one would be Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn. So when you see even to a certain extent the swashbuckling styles represented in the 73 Three Musketeers, that fencing style came from the 48 version, which came from Adventures of Robin Hood. So it's all bastardized and all related at some point. But I really like this movie. Definitely all the classics of the day are there. You have Gene Kelly, Lana Turner, Angela Lansbury, Vincent Price, some of the characters who were big then that people may or may not have heard of at the time, Van Heflin, June Allison, Frank Morgan is in it as well, who is the Wizard of Oz, for anybody who might know who that is, Gig Young, Robert Coote, Patricia Medina. So, I mean, again, a lot of people who we might not know today but are very well remembered in that period of history. Great flick. Highly recommend it. Second movie is a movie that I did debate about putting on this list, but it's just such a good movie that I wanted to go ahead and put it in. And it's Dances with Wolves. We've talked about it before. People know what it is.
It's like your favorite movie.
It really is one of my favorite movies. I know I keep coming back to it, and I always talk about it in different ways or whatever. But for a historical period movie, I really think that is one of the best. Getting back to something that is not Dances with Wolves or not Kevin Costner, we have 12 O'Clock High, which is a Gregory Peck movie directed by Henry King and produced by Daryl Zanuck, who did a lot of amazing movies in his day. It also has the other biggest name people might have a familiarity with in today's world, because it had Gary Merrill, Hugh Marlowe in it as well. Millard Mitchell was in it. These are all good period actors. But Dean Jagger. Now, you'll recognize Dean Jagger if you've watched this movie, or if you do watch this movie, you'll recognize Dean Jagger as the lovably gruff general that Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye try to save in White Christmas. Mm-hmm. So, and again, this was one of the movies, 12 O'Clock High, that actually got him an Academy Award nomination. He's just an amazing actor as well. So, you got to see this movie. This movie has Gregory Peck playing a brigadier general who's sent to basically shape up a kind of a failing bombing unit. And they have to be spruced up and sent in for increasingly difficult missions that are the key to advancing the war effort and the actual land invasions as they go forward in Germany in World War II. And he comes across as gruff and harsh and completely the antithesis of the person he's replacing as the unit head. But you come to find he loves these men. They're his brothers, they're his sons, they're his family to him, and he would do anything for them. And you see the camaraderie build, and it is just absolutely amazing. So, again, great movie. Highly recommend it. It's a wonderful flick. My last movie is another Gregory Peck flick, To Kill a Mockingbird. And you'll note none of my movies really have any factual dealings, but they do have great merit in terms of the periods of history that they cover. And this one is by far and away one of the most real in terms of how life was in the South back then, dealing with racism, how the court system worked, how people interacted with each other in a small town back then. So, again, and this movie, almost everybody's ever seen it, but this is, you know, about the lawyer Atticus Finch and his basically being the defense lawyer for a black man accused of raping a white woman. And this is back in, I want to say, back in the 30s, probably, that the movie takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine just exactly what kind of treatment the defendant is in for and exactly how the trial system worked, and is a great example of what segregation was really all about. And it really speaks to the values and morals of not just the society or the society then, but of people. And people who understood that all people are the same, and people who truly believed that there is a reason that other people are better or worse than others based solely on her race. So those are my movies: The 1948 Three Musketeers, Dances with Wolves, 12 O'Clock High, and To Kill a Mockingbird. So, 3 squared for next week. Your favorite franchise actor.
Ooh.
That's right. Favorite franchise actor. So, for example, if Tim wanted to say Harrison Ford, and I wanted to say Harrison Ford, we could, because I could say Harrison Ford from Star Wars, and he could say Harrison Ford from Indiana Jones.
Ooh.
So, yes, nice. Your favorite franchise actor. I think for fun, we should try and stick to the movies that are all in the same franchise, if it's at all possible.
Okay. That would make sense.
So, preferably some movie trilogy or something that's gone more than 3 movies. But I will accept, personally, I think it's fair to accept someone who's been in a couple of different franchises. And so you want to, you know, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of somebody who's been in different movie franchises or something. Okay, sure. For fun, maybe like Bruce Campbell. He's been in all the Spider-Man movies, and he was in all of the Evil Dead Army of Darkness movies. He's, you know what I'm saying? So you could pick a smattering from those, for example.
Okay.
So that's what I have for 3 squared.
Cool. All righty. So what are we going to do next?
I think it's time for the movies.
Yay. What are those?
Well, they're actually frames that are strung together consecutively at 24 per second that record visuals that are then later edited together to form one coherent piece that becomes a film.
That sounds like devil magic right there.
Doesn't it? We have Thomas Edison to thank for it.
Yes, that devil maker.
That bastard. With his devil pictures and his incandescent light bulbs.
incandescent light bulbs. Sounds like a Stephen King novel.
That's right.
The incandescent light bulb.
Right on. All right, so we had 3 movies. Let's see. We had Tron Legacy that we were both watching, Dirty Dozen that you watched, and Videodrome that I watched.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start, you know, just for fun, let's start with you. Dirty Dozen, what'd you think?
I loved it. It's hard to say anything bad about this film because after the 150 minutes of watching it, you just have a smile on your face. I mean, even though so many people die at the end, it's just such a fun movie. However, the whole pacing issue kind of, I wasn't too sure what to think about it about maybe 45 minutes into it. What I mean by it is that the film starts off as like a, to me at least, seemed like a cut straight drama. I mean, it starts off with a hanging of a prisoner. It's, you know, it's just dramatic as can be, pertaining to, I guess, war crimes within the U.S. Army. But then when it starts talking about this, these 12 men, who most of them are sentenced to be executed, are put together and go through this training to take on this basically a pretty much a suicide mission during World War II. Just these fun characters and like these little bitty goofs, and also seeing Lee Marvin like turn out to be this, not only, I mean, he's a good looking older gentleman, but he's like a total badass. Like, he just kicks the ass, like outsmarts all of them. He always has these witty comments, and you know, it just completely made up for the goofy comedy just gets thrown on you, that you're, I mean, it's just night and day different with basically the tone of the film. To whereas by the end of the film, when kind of all this drama is going on, you don't really get too emotionally invested, but instead of getting emotionally invested, you're just getting like invested in the moment, to where it's just building up in suspense until you're like, oh man, ooh, what's gonna happen? Oh, how are they gonna get out of this? And I'm not gonna spoil or try not to spoil any particular moments, but one of the soldiers basically loses their freaking mind, and you can kind of see it coming throughout the entire film. That's, you know, something not right's gonna happen to this character. Sure enough, all hell breaks loose, and it's just a fascinating, just pacing wise. It's just entertaining. It's directed by Robert Aldrich. It stars Lee Marvin, Ernest Borgnine, Charles Bronson is in it. It won the Academy Award for Best Sound Effects by John Pointer. Nominated for Academy Awards for Best Actor, John Cassavetes, who he played a, you know, really terrific part. One of the best characters, I think, in 1950s, 60s cinema. Best film editing, and also a best sound. This was all in 1968. So Dirty Dozen, I thought it was an excellent choice for me to watch, and I highly recommend it to all, especially if you're just a classic war movie fanatic. Even if you're not. I mean, I really don't think, if you're not a big fan of war movies in general, you can find some solace in the writing and character development and just sheer entertainment throughout. So, 2 thumbs
awesome.
Up.
Yay! That's outstanding. Okay, well then I will jump in here with Videodrome. And Videodrome is a David Cronenberg cult classic. And I am going to have to say, rightfully so, to say the least. Now,
oh.
This movie is so bad, it's good. Now, I am probably biased by the fact that I am a huge James Woods fan. And essentially, this movie is about a man by the name of Max Wren, played by James Woods. He is the president of what's called a of what's known as Civic TV, and basically it's just a low rent Toronto television station. It's like a UHF. So this is back when VHF was the main network channels at the time, and then you had a whole bunch of local stations and local translators that ran the UHF spectrum, and that's how you would get a whole bunch of extra channels, but typically they were terrible. This one is definitely bad. He's basically a sensationalist. He runs borderline pornography, ridiculous amounts of violence, all that kind of stuff. He, through his video station satellite programmer, he comes upon something called Videodrome, which is basically like a... It appears to be snuff TV, and they believe it to be translated from Asia. However, they find out that it's actually in the States, in Philadelphia. So he decides he's going to track it down and get Videodrome put on his station. He, through the course of events, he basically becomes embroiled in this, essentially this propaganda plot that shows that Videodrome is not anything of what it appears to be. It's not snuff television. It's actually television that controls the mind. They're using Videodrome to purge the weak and the immoral. And they can also, and it also, as it takes over the mind, they can program people to do the will of the people behind Videodrome, which is a corporation called the Spectacular Optical Corporation. So, James Woods, of course, is getting deeper and deeper covered into it, and of course, he gets twisted back and forth, and he's being used by the Videodrome people, and then there's another group that fights the Videodrome people, and he kind of goes back and forth being used by both, to be the deliverer, essentially. And that's kind of the movie. Now, what it does, though, is that as it takes over, you explore the depths of madness that actually happens to James Woods' character in the form of the hallucinations that he experiences, which include pulsating and bleeding televisions, increasingly ridiculous sadomasochistic visions. He has a love interest who seemingly doesn't exist but does exist, or whatever, I don't know. And the graphics get increasingly stupid, and he starts doing stuff like he has a gun that he puts into his stomach. And it was at this point that I just started laughing uncontrollably at this movie, because it was just so ridiculous. Like, oh boy, I'm going to need this for later. I don't need a holster. I'll put it in my stomach. You know, and sure enough, he does need it later on. He reaches into his stomach and pulls out the gun, and it's attached to his iron, and, you know, whatever, I don't know. So, yeah, it's just really weird. It's very visual, and the horror aspect comes in the terms of the actual... I'm trying to think of the right word here. The horror aspect of the movie comes from the actual transformation that these hallucinations create in James Woods' character. So it's very graphic. It's very sensual in some degree. In some ways, it's very sexual. It's very aggressive, and it can be frightening. But it's incredibly overdone, and that's what causes this movie to be so bad, is that everything is overdone, everything's over the top, and it's really the strength of James Woods' performance that salvages this movie in any way, shape, or form. Because I think halfway through the filming of this movie, he goes, this is just a complete waste of time, so I'm just going to I'm going to go with the flow, and I'm going to have the character that I portray pretty much just go with the flow from here on out. And he stops, and you can literally, it's almost like you see him trying to be regular old James Woods, playing a regular old James Woods character for the first half of the movie, and then he stops and just kind of goes with it. And he actually, I think, does a better job as it goes on. And it completely gets way more ludicrous and just way more ridiculous and way more offhanded until it eventually reaches some suicidal conclusion.
Oh, you gave it away.
So, again, I say this movie is so bad, it's good. And it is well deserved of its cult status. Because I can easily see how particular noir specialists or film aficionados take certain aspects of the movie, but basically the underlying points that the movie tries to make in terms of statements, political or otherwise, that it tries to get across, and how they're exploited. And I could see a case being made for how good the movie could be. Would I recommend it? Only to fans of James Woods and people who like Mystery Science Theater 3000. If you do not fall into those characters, or into those categories, do not watch this movie. If you do fall into one of those two categories, I guarantee you, you will appreciate this movie for what it is.
Oh, I highly disagree. Okay, so this will be added to, this will be your fourth movie you don't you disagree with on Rotten Tomatoes, since it holds 80%. Certified, or not, I guess you have to be 90s to be certified fresh, but it's 80% 70. Positive on Rotten Tomatoes.
70.
80.
70 is what it needs to be considered a certified fresh.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, and just as a quick rebuttal on my part, this is definitely a Cronenberg film. But it definitely fits in with a lot of other movies that make a particular statement about, you know, whether it be a technological statement or political statement. Such movies like Network, even Brazil, which Brazil by Terry Gilliam is a cultural statement. Clockwork Orange about Vietnam and war and the human psyche and all that good stuff. I just think, you know, just this movie, Videodrome, is fresh, or just something that pertains to now more so than, I don't know, maybe even the 80s, I guess, seeing how a lot of exploitation of video and sex and this and that, drugs and film and TV is just a lot, is more relevant more so now than ever. And I gotta say,
and like I said, there are going to be people who will look at the underlying issues that this movie talks about, and they will make a case for this movie being good based on what it's trying to say about them. And I am totally not trying to take that away from you or the
don't
consensus.
Take it away.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to do that. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, I don't
but
care.
We're looking take at it, but we're also looking at it from two different perspectives. And I will say this in my defense of both my opinion of Rotten Tomatoes and Rotten Tomatoes. With the quote fresh rating system, it's not a lot of the stuff is based on the reviews that were available for it at the time. That's not to say that there may or may not be current reviews for it or anything, but a lot of the people who reviewed movies back in the 80s I didn't like and I didn't agree with.
Well, actually, a lot of
most of these are within the last 10 years, though. It looks like I see a couple from 2005, one from 2004,
2011, 2010, 2011, 2008.
Yeah, 2000. They're like, all the one, yeah, sure. The bad one is 2006 here. They got a good one from 2004, but yeah, I don't know. It just it definitely the people who like this movie are definitely going at the underlying issues that the movie is trying to talk about, how sex and violence can affect you, and how video the subject matter of what you watch can control you and make you and alter your thinking more than you realize it does. And to a certain extent, they're right. I mean, look at the amount of sex in TV there was back when this movie came out. Look at the amount of sex in TV today. Sure, look at Grand Theft Auto. I mean, when you let a 10-year-old kid play Grand Theft Auto and they're 15, do you think they're going to have any compunction about looking at somebody who just got shot in the head? No. Because they've been doing it for 5 years, you know?
Yeah, honestly, I really don't have any, you know. Like, I can watch a violent movie and not, you know, look away or anything like that. It's kind of sad.
And again, so again, if you look at these people who are talking about who like this movie, they're basing their like of this movie on the issues of what the movie is about, not on the merits of the filmmaking itself. For the most part.
I definitely say the merits of the filmmaking as well. I mean, the movie is visually, well, in my opinion, it's visually striking and fun to look at, and I like the lack of character. I like the lack of character progression, but then again, within the lack of character progression, there is definitely a progression in sensibility, or maybe insensibility, I suppose, within James Woods' character. I don't. It's one of those movies that's really hard to explain. It's either you like it or you don't.
Sure. And here's a positive. I'll give you a snippet. Here's a prime example. This is from TV Guide's Movie Guide, dated June 6th, 2007, and I am reading the thesis statement, and it says, and this is a positive review, David Cronenberg's most visionary and audacious film up to the time of its making, Videodrome is a fascinating rumination on humanity, technology, entertainment, sex, and politics that is virtually incomprehensible on first viewing. So,
there you go. That's actually a pretty good way to sum it up.
I think that's a very good way to sum it up. And the key words for me are virtually incomprehensible. And that's okay. And again, that's okay. That's why I say some people going into it today, for the most part, in my opinion, if you're not a fan of James Woods or you're not a fan of MST3K, you're probably not going to like this film. However, I say again, there are certainly those who would be able to watch a movie like this and pick out the themes and the underlying subjects about what this movie is and make a case for why the movie's good. And as clearly you have, and most of the people here who have reviewed the movie are. But I'm sorry, when I see someone go in to an eyeglass shop and they go to the back and the dude in the back takes a videotape and then shoves it into your stomach so you can go assassinate somebody and then comes out with a bloody stump of a hand, not the best movie making I've ever seen. I'm sorry, not going to go with it, you know?
Because Hobo with a Shotgun made complete sense.
We're not going to go there again because we both, whether or not we like the movie, I think we both can agree with that specific movie that it was supposed to be a throwback to that particular type of movie.
It was supposed to be.
Whether or not it succeeded, because you think it didn't, and I think it did, is irrelevant. We both understand that the concept of the movie was to be a throwback to movies of that era.
Yeah.
This movie is supposed to be, in and of itself, for lack of a better term, serious. You're supposed to be scared. You're supposed to be, you know, involved in the intensity of the moment, of what's going on, and how he's trying to, you know, do whatever it is that he's doing, and the, you know, and how they're really trying to control everybody and everything. But I'm sorry, when you stick a videotape into somebody's stomach and it comes out as a bloody stump of a hand, I'm not buying. I'm not buying.
So you're saying that's never happened to you, Matt?
You said you wouldn't tell. You promised.
I can't keep it out anymore.
It's the Prince of Tides.
I have no hand because of you.
It's the Prince of Tides all over again. Stop it.
All right, so...
Tron. Let's talk Tron Legacy.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good.
Okay, I thought... Okay, this movie for me, as compared to the original, I thought was way better. The technologically speaking, they are both amazing in terms of pushing the boundaries of technology at the time.
Correct.
Tron did it back in the early 80s, 84, I think, 82, 84. Tron Legacy does it today. The facial mapping is ridiculous, although the facial map to Jeff Bridges kind of creeped me the hell out, but whatever. Neither here nor there. It was still a fantastic technological feat. The story, and again, I did not watch Tron before I watched Tron Legacy, so I'm going off of, it's been way more than a decade since I've seen Tron. So I'm trying to go off of what I remembered about it, because I reread the plot just to kind of refresh the story. In my head, okay, yeah, sure, I remember what all happened. And it is a sequel. I mean, it is a true sequel to Tron. I don't remember Jeff Bridges' character, because I can't think of the name off the top of my head right now. Because Tron is actually
Flynn.
Bruce... Yeah, Flynn, thank you. Yeah, because Tron is actually Bruce Boxleitner's character inside inside the program. That's actually Tron. But and he's, you know, the protector or whatever. But... yeah, Jeff Bridges' character, Flynn, I don't remember him being the whacked-out Steve Jobs hippie that he portrays in Tron Legacy. I don't remember him being like that in Tron. Maybe he was, and I was just too young to understand it, but I don't know. I wasn't feeling that. In terms of the story, I thought that the story was a much faster-paced story and a better... and a more balanced story than it was in Tron, because Tron was so slow. It's a good movie. It's just really, really slow. Tron Legacy seemed to fix that, and so I was enjoying the pacing of it. In terms of sheer technological brilliance, again, both of them pushing the boundaries of technology at the time. So I thought it was a visually stunning movie. I thought that the pacing issues were pretty minimal, but so was the plot. Plot was pretty minimal as well. But I did walk away from the movie enjoying it. And as a matter of fact, my daughters, 4 and almost 2, sat and watched the movie with me. Now, I'm sure they were just, you know, they were just attracted to all the pretty colors. But still, for them to sit down for 2 hours and 20 minutes, I thought was pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, so I thought the movie was pretty good. I enjoyed it. Was it the best movie I've ever seen? No. Would I recommend it to others? Yeah, I think I would. It's a popcorn movie. I don't expect a whole lot from it, but visually it's good. The pacing is pretty good. The plot's really thin. But other than that, I would still recommend it. It's pretty good flick.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I kind of stand with it as well. I dig the music. I really like how they kept with the electronica theme with the music, to where there was a lot of synthesizers. A lot of it, especially kind of at the beginning of the movie, very very retro sounding music, and I dig it. The look of it was pretty cool. I really didn't care for Olivia Wilde's character as the female, the chick of the movie, because it just seemed like she was just the chick of the movie for the sole purpose of having a chick in the movie.
I can agree with that, sure.
Yeah, and so it kind of hammed it up a little bit. And the one thing that I just felt weird was that I had no idea that Tron was like a city. Like there was actually like a city of people, and I just really didn't understand. I didn't really buy the whole storyline. Like, oh well. Or, well, I don't. Well, Tron's not a city, but, you know, the city, whatever the, you know, the place where they're at.
The grid.
Yeah, the grid. There you go. I mean, I love the whole setup of the grid, like the beginning of the movie, like the narration where the grid and something, something, something. And it goes from, like, the electronic grid to, I guess, Los Angeles, where they're at. So, I mean, it's really, I mean, the movie is visually entertaining, but if you start thinking about it, it does not make sense. You know, like, you're just kind of like, I don't understand the logic, but you know, that's okay. I mean, given the confines of the movie and how it was, you know, it is a popcorn flick. It's entertaining. It could have been better, sure, but for what it is, you know, I liked it. Cliche, but apparently they're supposed to be making another one to continue the story. So we'll see what happens.
Okay, and I think we did a really piss poor job of talking about what this movie's about. So. From Rotten Tomatoes, just because I thought maybe it's, you know, for someone who doesn't know what the movie's about. Essentially, The Master Control Program is booted back up, and this revamped Tron continuation that sees the return of original star Jeff Bridges is Kevin Flynn, the brilliant computer programmer whose disappearance leads his son, Sam, to search for him in and out of the computer world. There you go.
Yeah, and the movie also has Journey in it. Like, they have 80s rock music, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. I think it's a little unfair. It's the ultimate typecasting. If you need a standby 80s song to go to, you can pretty much hit any Journey song, and someone's going to go, oh, yeah, this must be taking place in the 80s.
Yeah, no, it's like the same thing with Bon Jovi. I mean, it's like, oh, that's the 80s.
Oh, Bon Jovi was 90s, too.
Well, true, but whenever you think of, you know, that one song he sings.
Because there's a whole bunch of them, so I'm going to need more than that one. Living on a Prayer.
Yeah, Living on a Prayer, Dead or Alive. Or maybe that, yeah. Well, I guess 80s, 90s, late 80s. But, yeah. Or Def Leppard. There you go. Whenever I hear Def Leppard.
Oh, yeah, Def Leppard. Another good 80s only band.
Yeah.
So, outstanding. Okay, so we disagreed on Videodrome, agreed on Dirty Dozen, and essentially I think we agree on Tron Legacy 2. Yeah?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay, sweet. So, I guess let's talk some Twilight Zone?
Yes.
Okay, so we had I Shot an Arrow into the Air. Now, this one is basically about some astronauts who are in an experimental craft. I can't remember if it's experimental or not, but it's definitely a spacecraft of some form or fashion. They believe that they have crash landed on what appears to be a barren asteroid. Now, I immediately have a problem here because they already used the asteroid thing in Lonely.
Right.
So I was a little disappointed that they're already recycling stuff 15 episodes into the first season. But with little water and almost no hope of survival, the men gradually turn on one another, and you know, and then they realize they're much closer to home than what they thought. So, what gets me about this one is I thought that the acting was good. I enjoyed the acting. I liked the characters. You definitely get the feeling of, from the get-go, who the bad guy is. And that's okay. I mean, sometimes it's okay just to go with simple. So I was fine with the acting. I was fine with the conflict and stuff. I was disappointed that they were already recycling stuff. And spoiler alert, because it's important to why I didn't like this one, I was really pissed off that they end up on Earth. They crash-landed in Nevada. So what they thought was a barren asteroid was, in reality, they were just in the middle of the desert.
And how did nobody notice a rocket crashing? Like,
number one, that. Number two, come on. I mean, how do you not know you didn't make it out of Earth's atmosphere to begin with? I mean, you're in a spaceship. You should pretty much know that if you went black and then it went immediately back blue again, that you didn't go anywhere. You know, so I was really disappointed that the twist ending puts them back on Earth like they never even left, because they should have just freaking known better. So I was really disappointed with this episode in terms of the plot, in terms of the plot devices of the crash landing and then the twist ending. Those really hacked me off. But the actual character development and the story development in between, I thought was really good.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, the execution of it was entertaining. But yeah, no. Agree completely.
Outstanding. Very good. So then our next episode is The Hitchhiker. And that will be interesting. This one actually has we're going back to a female lead, which I can't really think of a female lead since 16mm Shrine, which still stands as my favorite episode up to this point. And I guess it's our movie recommendation then will be, we can do that real quick.
The King and I.
King and I, Deborah Kerr, Yul Brynner. So,
yes.
Excellent. That was actually the reason why Yul Brynner remained bald for the rest of his life. Was the
Oh, really? He actually had hair before?
He did. He had a nice head of hair. But he shaved it to play the king in The King and I. But the thing is that he did the entire Broadway run. So he had been shaving his head for like 3 years before they did the movie. And so he shaved his head for like another year during the movie. And when he was finally done with the Broadway production and the movie, his hair would never grow back right.
Really?
So he just kept it shaved for the rest of his life.
Wow. Well, it suits him. perfectly.
I know. He's a badass-looking guy, especially when you go back and look at the Magnificent Seven and everything. I mean, you know, because he's bald in that, too. And, you know, I mean, he's just a badass-looking dude.
Yeah.
He's the original, I shave my head because I want to, badass. You know, I think that's just where it's at. So definitely check that out. And the movies that we're going to be watching for next week, we're going to go and see the new George Clooney flick, The Descendants. It's been getting rave reviews. Did pretty good in the movie theaters. You know, it can't really, I guess, compete against garbage like Twilight. But whatever. Oh, you know what? There is actually, I will try to get this done. But on Failblog, failblog.org, there's actually a win. Occasionally they'll put a win in there, even though there's now an entire section dedicated to win. But it's someone who wrote a note inside of Twilight at the bookstore and stuck it in there, and someone else found it and took a picture of it. And the note inside says, please, Stephanie Meyer is not a good author. Please don't read this crap. And recommends a really good book by a really well... I can't think of the author or the book, but it's a really good book by another classic author. Please read this. That's much better. And it was in the book. It's inside the Twilight book on the shelf. And someone took a picture of it. So I'll see if I can try and find that picture and provide a link for it, because I thought that was pretty funny. But yeah, so we're going to see the new George Clooney, The Descendants. I have been recommended to see Black Narcissus with Deborah Kerr.
Mm-hmm.
Since we were doing a Deborah Kerr flick already with King and I, kind of dreamt in there. And since King and I is a musical, I recommended Star, which is the Julie Andrews musical about Gertrude Lawrence. And it's definitely, it's 1968, it's very edgy. It was the last, because it was so late in the world of musicals and stuff, people were kind of falling away from it, so it did not do well in the theater, but it still garnered Academy Award nominations and Academy Awards and stuff like that. But, I highly recommend it. I think, it's going to be good. And then, that's it. We've made it.
Finally.
Just.
After, like, 3 weeks. Or two weeks.
3 weeks.
A handful of weeks.
Something like that.
Yeah, a bundle of weeks.
And then we'll start looking into Christmas stuff. If anybody wants to send us some recommendations for Christmas movies to check out, Three Squared related to Christmas, anything like that, you know, that'd be good. Because you can always catch us by doing it with the email or leaving the comments and all that stuff, so... Speaking of which, I guess we should probably do that too, huh?
Oh, yes. Oh, the wrap-up.
Yeah, sure. There we go. The wrap-up. The spiel, as we used to call it in the Wow Factor show. You can catch us on the web. Just simply go to slscast.com. You can send us an email, and you can send that to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @theslscast. And, of course, you can always go to the website and... leave comments there. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and leave comments there as well. And that is it. We hope to catch you guys again soon and not let life get in the way for too much longer.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Graduation soon for me, so.
Yay!
Graduation. I'll have all the free time.
There you go. And that is it, my friends. So we will catch you guys on the flip side.
Alrighty, take care, dudes. Or chicks. And chicks. What if we had more chicks and dudes as listeners?
I'm not sure. I think we would probably have to change our theme song to the Flight of the Conchords one. Too many dicks on the dance floor.
Oh, too many dicks on the dance floor. Too many dicks.
Yeah. All right. Y'all have a good time. We'll catch you next time.
Adios.
A cold drink, beer, ice, milk, bread, and all-night videotape rental.